From the features staff at the Columbus Dispatch, this is Life in the 614. Hi, and welcome to Life in the 614, the official lifestyle podcast of the features department at the Columbus Dispatch, coming to you every Thursday. If it sounds like fun, we'll be talking about it. I'm Ryan Smith, assistant features editor at the Dispatch, and I'm here in studio today with my colleague, lifestyle reporter Allison Ward. These are magical times that we live in. Don't believe me? The Columbus Symphony's opening concert of the season is proof. Its programs Friday and Saturday feature a number of pieces from Walt Disney's Fantasia, including, of course, The Sorcerer's Apprentice. No word on whether there will be an appearance by Mickey. And even though I don't know how to play, I'm pretty sure that there's going to be some sort of spells or magic at work when the Yu-Gi-Oh! Championship Series comes to the Greater Columbus Convention Center this weekend. The event serves as a world championship qualifier for the popular Japanese card game. Tournament play begins at 10 a.m. Saturday and 9 a.m. Sunday. But most magical of all? Well, according to our guest today, that may have been back in 1968 to 1969. That's the school year when East High in Columbus, a largely poor and black school, won both the baseball and basketball state championships. Will Haygood explores the significance of that time in his new book, Tigerland, 1968 to 1969, A City Divided, A Nation Torn Apart, and A Magical Season of Healing. It's just the latest book for Haygood, a Columbus native, who also wrote the piece that became the basis for the hit movie, The Butler. He has three upcoming appearances in the area: Thursday, September 20th, at East High School, Sunday, September 23rd, at Bexley High School, and October 8th at the Wexner Center for the Arts. Thanks for joining us today, Will. Maybe something you could do to get us started would talk about the inspiration for the book. You know, what made now the right time for this book?
Well, it actually started 4 years ago, when I finished my last book, and then I was looking around for something else to write, and I was thinking about a magazine article. And then I talked to my editor in New York, and I was telling him about this high school in 1968, 1969, segregated Columbus, et cetera, et cetera. And he said, wow, that sounds like a book to me. And so it started then. However, with this point in history, what the country is going through, revisiting African-American athletes who stood up for equal rights in the 60s, and now you have Colin Kaepernick and his movement. It's very interesting that the book happens to be coming out at this time, because these athletes were there in 68, 69 when there was a whole lot of protests, and the Vietnam War was going on. And so it is a book whose time has come, I think, in the orbit of social activism, athletes, and looking back at what happened in this country 50 years ago.
Do you think the lessons that it has to offer today's audience is a little bit different maybe than what you intended when you started 4 years ago?
Yes. It never was going to be just a straightaway sports narrative. I did not want to write a sports book. I wanted to write, you know, a deep social history of this country, using East High School and these two championship teams as the spokeswheel, sort of. But this is a country that cannot resolve its racial nightmare. It's a shame, but we have Nazi marches in this country and Ku Klux Klan marches. We have people who've been in the White House recently talking about white nationalism. And, you know, it is. There is no doubt about it. You know, it's a very, very dangerous moment in this country. It was Abraham Lincoln who said a house divided cannot stand. And we know now that this country is very divided. And I think that the beautiful thing about this story is that these athletes, and they were young, you know, 17 and 18 years old, showed the country that there is a way forward, because there was a lot of pain in this city, really a lot of pain in this city, more than a lot of other cities. And I explain in the book the reason why. Martin Luther King Jr. himself had made several visits here. He had a dear friend, Reverend Fail Hale, who is a local minister, and they knew each other in Georgia. And so Fail Hale and his followers at his church were very hurt. Some of the players went to that church, you know, and so the King murder was very visceral here.
Well, yeah, and you mentioned a lot of different details in the book, from, you know, that whole story you just told to the basketball coaches' World War II experiences, and then Dwight Bo Peep Lamar being thrown off his original school for, you know, wearing an afro or wearing his hair in an afro style. You know, what exactly was the research process like for this book to get those details? And I know you interviewed tons and tons of people. So tell me a little bit about the research process.
First of all, I had to track down as many of the athletes as I could. And there were a significant number of them still living here in Columbus. And those living elsewhere, I made trips and I was able to track down a few teachers from that year. But goodness, one of the most significant finds for me was Paul Pinnell. He was the assistant basketball coach and head baseball coach. So he was a part of both of those teams. So I was very lucky. You know, he's still living here in the city. He's very sharp mentally. And thank goodness, he's a pack rat. He saved records from 68 game scores, scrapbooks. And that was just absolutely phenomenal. His wife was still living at the time. And she had a wonderful memory. You know, and so these were white coaches and their wives who loved these black kids, who just loved what they were doing as members of a team. So I would, you know, it just felt very lucky to find them. Newspapers here at the Dispatch archives. I mean, found the Dispatch archives and at the Library of Congress, Washington, D.C., and I would sit there on the microfiche and scroll through it all day long, and first draft of history, as we call journalism, you know. And so that was very, very helpful. And then there was a Citizen Journal that was here too. Something that really, I think, slowed my research was there was a black local newspaper here, the Columbus Column Post. For some reason, the entire file from 1968 to 1969 has gone missing. Wow. Somebody took it. Yes. And I needed that. I'm still haunted by the fact that it's gone, you know, and I never.
And they have all the other years. That's the only one missing.
Yep. 68, 69. Yep. Totally missing. And so it was a coach who I was lucky enough to find. And it was the players, and it was newspaper archives, and it was students who I tracked down from that year, school teachers who I tracked down from that year. And there's just the thing that I love doing, researching moments in this nation's history, you know. And so I would zero in on all of the tragic things that happened in 68. In 69. And so there's a lot of history in the book.
And who would you say it was one of your favorite? I mean, I don't want to use the word characters because they're all real people. But who was maybe some of your favorite people you met through this process, or, you know, that you got to write about or learn about? You know, maybe some of your more interesting interviews?
Yes, there's this guy named Roy Hickman, who was a starter on the state championship basketball team. Now, my family moved from the north side to the east side when I was 13 years old. And there was this local playground, Monroe Junior High School, where I was going to enter that fall, in the fall of 68, I was going to enter. I did not know Roy Hickman at all, but I would sometimes see him at the playground running drills by himself. And all these years later, 48 years later, when I flew here to town and got in a rental car and drove over to the west side and spent a whole afternoon with him, I said, I remember when I was a little kid, I would see you at the playground running drills alone. And he said, the reason I did that in 95 degree heat is because Bob Hart, who was a basketball player, had told me when I was in the 11th grade that he could not assure me that I would make the team the following year. And I needed to make that team. I mean, he was looking at some other players who he thought were much better than me, but I knew if I had a good summer, and I practiced every day. And my mom and dad told me that I didn't have to have a job because I cared about making that team. He said, then I thought I had a chance. And goodness, it's just a magical little story of this guy named Roy Hickman, who was told that he might not make the team at all the following year. And he goes out, and not only does he make the team, but in several games, he was acknowledged as the unsung hero of that game. And, you know, he ended up playing on a state championship team. Just a wonderful story about a guy like me, because I never was really good, but I loved playing basketball. And so he reminded me of myself, you know, his drive.
You mentioned, you know, that you're here in Columbus while all of this is going on. What's it like writing and researching a story that doesn't have just historical implications, but has personal ones too? And how did what you find align with your own memories?
Yeah, super question. Most of the people I've written about, for some reason in life, have been historical figures. Sugar Ray Robinson, he was dead when I started the book. So was Sammy Davis Jr., and so was Adam Clayton Powell, and so was Thurgood Marshall. This is a book where most of these characters are, you know, still here, breathing, walking around. And so I thought that would be really fun, to write a book and then be able to talk to the people who are in the book and see the joy spread across their face. You know, hopefully they'll all like the book, love the book. One thing that I think was special in my doing this book is that I lived on the north side, right? Okay. I lived on the north side, right off North 4th Street, near Wyland Park Playground. Then I moved to the east side. And when you're a kid and there's no other males in the household and you move to a completely different neighborhood, it's a little scary. And so I was afraid of losing my friends, my school teachers. All that was really sort of radical to me. And yet I had moved to this segregated part of town, mostly black, you know, the school all black, shouldn't have been all black, you know, from the 1954 Supreme Court decision, but it was. And so I had to find my way and I had to grow into who I was. And I think doing this book gave me a much larger appreciation for the people who worked so hard to keep the community going on the east side.
So you and I spoke last year as you were kind of just finishing up your research and you were getting ready to start writing at the fellowship that you had at Washington College. And yeah. I know when I talked to you back then, you said that I wake up some mornings and I can't wait to get started writing this book. Why did this story fascinate you so much? And did that reign true, you know, through your writing process, that you were excited to write about it?
Yes. First, I think it was fun to write about it because I know the joy of athletes, you know, high school athletes. And that really made it super, super fun. Also, there was this. I was constantly getting cut from sports tryouts. And so I would always have to go ask the coach for a second chance. But I knew that there was nobody who was going to cut me as I was writing this book. I just saw the road ahead. And it really made me happy because here's the example. Thurgood Marshall, that's a lawyer. So I really had to study legal terms, legalese, for like a whole 8 months before I really felt comfortable writing that book. And then I wrote a book about Sugar Ray Robinson, who was a famous boxer in the 40s and 50s. I really didn't know much about boxing, so I had to watch a whole lot of vintage fight films of his from the 40s and 50s. But basketball and baseball in Tigerland, I know that world. And so it wasn't as hard for me to climb through that tunnel as it was for some of the other books. I think the very difficult thing in this book was, you think of books to movies or very popular sports stories like Hoosiers and Remember the Titans and Friday Night Lights. Okay, those teams were about one quest for one championship. This school had two journeys and two championships in the same year. It's still sort of stunning to me that a high school could do this. It's just a rare feat. It just is. And so I knew that I was going to have to tell two stories in this book, and I didn't think that would be easy.
And you call it a season of healing. Talk about how the accomplishments of a sports team can actually create healing like this. What did you find?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that many people, when the Eastside Tigers started winning, started going to the Fairgrounds Coliseum to see them play. And when you're at the Coliseum, you're all sitting together, whites, blacks, young, old, and it forces you to talk about the game. And I think sports figures have always sort of been respected enough to take a role in the struggle for integration here in this country. Yeah, because, you know, sports figure is going to wind up in the newspaper. Sports figure will be quoted often. And so I think that year of victory for the Tigers forced blacks and whites in this city to talk about something good. It wasn't about rioting. It wasn't about the fact that OSU had shut down. It wasn't about the horrific things that were happening in this nation. It was about, hey, look at what these kids at East High School are doing. And so that made for moments of healing and moments of joy. It really did. I mean, some schools walked out, you know, in 69. Students walked out, marched out of the school. We're upset. Things aren't fair around here, et cetera, et cetera. But East High School did not ever stage a walkout.
I was just going to say, I mean, you mentioned Remember the Titans and Friday Night Lights, some of the big sports movies. I mean, do you think this could be turned into a movie like your previous essay, The Butler?
You know, if I were a savvy movie director with some credits in Hollywood, I would snatch up this book in a minute. I just think it just has a lot of, you know, juice, you know, for the screen, for the, you know, I don't know, maybe a 5-part miniseries, maybe a big motion picture, who knows? I don't know, but, you know, it is a very cinematic story. It is.
Well, we'll be happy to take any calls from big-time directors on your behalf.
Thank you.
and I wanted to ask, since we're speaking of movies, how does life change for someone once Oprah Winfrey stars in a movie based on something you've written?
Yeah, you know, more people know me for The Butler than for my other books. Now, I'm very proud of that movie, but, you know, I've spent a lot of years writing some very big 450-page books. I love talking about those books, too, you know. But this is such a nation where we go to the movies every weekend. Movie stars are always in the news, and I think that's why The Butler rolls on. Goodness, and it's still playing in some foreign countries. You know, it has now played in like 79 foreign countries, which is astonishing to me. The son of the butler, Charles Allen, just came back from a film festival in South America where the lead film was The Butler, you know, 5 years later. It's just amazing. It's still going out there.
And what's your next project? What's next from you?
Yes, well, I have another book that's coming out. I have no idea how I was able to write two books, but I have a book coming out about the Harlem Renaissance. It comes out in October, and it is tied to an exhibit celebrating the 100th anniversary of the, you know, the start of the Harlem Renaissance. And it's in conjunction with the Columbus Museum of Art. It's a big 250-page hardback book with a lot of gorgeous photographs. They're just stunning, stunning photographs. So I will be back in town next month for the rollout of that.
Outstanding. Well, it sounds like we've got a lot of reading to do.
Yep.
We'll get to that, but thanks so much for joining us today, Will.
Yeah, thanks, Will.
Thank you. It was wonderful.
And thank you all for listening to Life in the 614. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Google Play Music. We hope to have you back next week. Until then, keep enjoying your own life in the 614.